Definitely, for spiritual. Yay. The traditions lay out the spiritual principles that apply to our groups just as surely as the 12 steps lay out the spiritual principles that apply to the individual in recovery. But before we take a closer look at the traditions, I'd like to share just a little bit of my story for those of you who don't know me yet or who don't know me very well. I first came into 12-step recovery in 1998 as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And over 25 years later, late in 2023, I was introduced to ACA. From the moment I first read the laundry list and then the problem and the solution, I identified completely with adult children of alcoholics and dysfunctional families, which I found a little strange at first because there were absolutely no alcohol or drugs in my childhood home until I brought them there. I knew that my maternal grandfather had been an alcoholic. He died an alcoholic death when my mother was only 5 years old, something the family didn't talk about much. But I found it unbelievable that the shadow of his alcoholism had been cast over our family. And yet, I sensed very strongly that something deep and important was missing from my recovery. And I had reached a point where I thought I would need to create my own recovery program to address the untreated trauma of childhood when suddenly ACA was presented to me. And right there in the ACA literature in black and white was the program I had been looking for. That strong sense of identification, I believe, is the first prerequisite for finding the unity that's described in our first tradition, which we'll talk about a little more in just a few moments. My first AA sponsor encouraged me, or should I say, strongly suggested to me, that as soon as I had reached the 6 months sobriety required in our group at that time for taking a service position, I should take one. And I followed that suggestion, first becoming our intergroup representative and then later serving as the group secretary and finally as treasurer. Now, obviously, I don't need to sell anyone here on the benefits of service, because you wouldn't be in an intergroup meeting on a Sunday evening if you weren't already convinced. But what I will say is that nothing has challenged nor strengthened my recovery as much as service work. And nothing has challenged nor strengthened my service work as much as working within the 12 traditions. In some groups, the traditions of the fellowship are almost treated as an afterthought. We may read them at our meetings, but we act as if we believe that they just sort of run in the background while we carry out the important work of sharing at meetings and talking with our sponsor or fellow traveler, or reading the literature and working the 12 steps. But the fact is that, like the steps, the traditions don't work if we don't work them. They don't run in the background. And our groups are not automatically healthy. And I've heard it expressed many different ways over the years, but the way I like to think of it is this: the 12 steps provide me with a set of spiritual practices that teach me to live with myself. And the 12 traditions provide me with a set of spiritual practices that teach me to live with others. And I very definitely need both. I don't know how many times in recovery, I've heard somebody say something like, "I don't know how this works. I just work the steps and trust the process." Well, I'm not sure whether I can shed any light on how it works, but I do think I've stumbled onto an important clue as to why 12-step recovery works so well when it does work. And I believe it's because both the steps and the traditions are self-enforcing. And by that, I mean, I've noticed that people who don't work the steps tend to fall away from our groups. And groups that don't work the traditions tend to fall away from the fellowship. Working the traditions ensures that our group will be there for the next adult child who needs us. So, with that introduction, let's take a closer look at a few of the traditions and their underlying principles and see how they apply in our groups. Now, obviously, we don't have time today to do a deep dive into any one tradition, let alone all 12. But if you ever have the opportunity to participate in a deeper tradition study and haven't already done so, I would strongly encourage you. With the time we have today, I'd like for us to briefly consider the four traditions that seem to come up the most when our group runs into trouble. Tradition one, which deals with unity, tradition 12, anonymity, tradition five, which talks about group purpose, and tradition two, which is group conscience and lack of governing. So tradition one says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on ACA unity. In the very first tradition, we're hit with a strange sounding concept. I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that as adult children of alcoholics and dysfunctional families, the common welfare did not come first in our families of origin. Now, maybe dad's welfare came first because the slightest infraction of his rules could send him flying off into a rage. Or maybe mom's welfare came first because anything we did to disappoint her could cause her to threaten to leave us or actually leave us. Maybe our younger siblings' welfare came first because if we didn't take care of them, there was no one else to do it. But the common welfare was unknown and not talked about. So, on top of that, we run into a seeming paradox with this tradition. If the solution is to become my own loving parent, how will I ever do that by putting the common welfare before my own needs? Well, I believe the answer to that one is simply that I cannot get well and stay well alone. In order to recover, I must be in the company of others. It's precisely because I need the support of my ACA group in order to recover that I must learn to put our common welfare first. And furthermore, I don't believe that a loving parent wants me to do it alone. See, isolation was what little Mark did to survive conflict and escape the pain. A loving parent wants me to love myself and others, to be in relationship and fellowship, to be in unity with ACA. But are we really saying that my own recovery depends on placing the common welfare first? Yes. The tr first tradition is telling me precisely that when my own needs and desires come into conflict with the needs of the group's welfare must be placed above my own will. Now, please hear me clearly on this point. Tradition one applies to the unity of our groups and the fellowship as a whole. It is definitely not instructing me to place another individual's needs ahead of my own. And it certainly isn't suggesting that I should make common cause with dangerous people. The first tradition, like all of our traditions, is there to keep us safe and healthy. It's not to place us in danger. So, what is this unity we're talking about in tradition one? Well, let's start by saying what it isn't. Unity is not unanimity. We're not always going to agree. Unity is a spiritual principle that allows us to resolve our differences and remain whole when we do disagree. It begins with the identification I mentioned earlier. Our individual experiences of abandonment, abuse, and rejection in childhood may seem very different on the surface, but when we look deeper, we see that what we have in common is far more than our superficial differences. We all reacted to adult challenges with coping mechanisms that we learned in childhood. When we see ourselves clearly in the laundry list and the problem, and when we start to believe that the solution is possible for us, we begin to realize we're part of a whole that's much greater than the sum of its parts. That's unity. And how do we practice it? Well, we practice it by working the rest of the 12 traditions to ensure and enlarge our sense of safety and belonging in the group. And we place the common welfare first whenever we agree to chair a meeting or make coffee or help arrange the furniture. We practice unity whenever we listen to other members' shares with our full attention and an open heart. Just as the 12 steps help us to integrate the members of our inner family into a unity, a whole or true self, so the 12 traditions help us to integrate the members of our ACA family into a unity, a whole or true fellowship. As children of unhealthy families, we are now learning to be adult members of a healthy one. Now, if unity is the cornerstone of our 12 traditions, tradition 12 supplies the foundation. It states, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. This tradition reminds us that anonymity has an immense spiritual significance and serves as the thread that weaves our traditions together and promotes our personal safety and strengthens us in our unity. And it means, of course, that we use our given names in meetings, that we don't publicize our membership in ACA, and that we don't talk about another person's story outside of meetings or gossip about them. I know that none of you would ever do that, but I have certainly been guilty. And I found it necessary to correct my behavior and work on that. But it also means much more than those things. Anonymity also promotes a genuine humility that reminds me that the principles of the program take precedence over the personalities that make up our group, especially my personality. It reminds me to practice anonymity in service. And I'll give you an example. One day a year or so ago, I attended an AA meeting at our local clubhouse. And I noticed on my way into the meeting that the property had become overgrown and it looked poorly cared for. And at the end of that meeting, the secretary announced that the group's lawnmower had broken down and they were looking for a volunteer to clean up the yard while they raised funds for a new mower. So after the meeting, I went home, loaded up my truck with lawn equipment, and went back and spent a couple of hours mowing, trimming, and clipping. But the whole time I was out there working, I was also secretly hoping that another member would show up or at least drive by and see what I was doing. And even better, that they might announce at the next meeting, "Hey, everybody, it was Mark who did the yard work." So my impulse to help was the right one, but my desire for personal recognition was not in keeping with the 12th tradition. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting it's wrong for us to recognize and celebrate each other for our service. I mean, it feels wonderful when somebody says to us, "Thank you for your service." And it feels even better when we're able to say that to them. But what I am suggesting is that I need to cultivate the genuine humility to help my ACA group because the group needs help and not because I need the recognition. Recently, our group in Tallahassee decided to record a brief history of our group, which dates back to December 2023. And when the document appeared, it contained the names of the founding members, along with the names of everyone who had held a service position along the way. We considered that together and decided that this was not consistent with the spirit of Tradition 12. First of all, some of those who were included have since left the group, and they might not want to be memorialized in that way. But more fundamentally, the name of the treasurer is not what's important. What's important is that the treasurer is accurately collecting, reporting, and distributing funds so that the group is faithfully practicing the seventh tradition. And speaking of the seventh tradition, do your groups allow for e-payment contributions? Our group uses Venmo in addition to passing the basket at the meeting, which means that with the Venmo contributions, the treasurer is able to see who's contributing and how much. Now, it occurs to me, if anonymity is the spiritual foundation of Tradition 7, should the treasurer really know that Jane gave $20 while John gave $2? I don't pretend to know the answer, and clearly I'm not making anybody wrong for accepting e-payments. Each group is autonomous. That's Tradition 4, and they can make that decision for themselves. I'm just throwing it out as an example of what starts to occur to you when you start looking deeply at the traditions. But back to group history. If you've ever been a member of a new group or a new meeting, you're probably familiar with the very natural human tendency to think of it for a while as Jane's group or John's meeting, because Jane and John were the ones who started it. And what I'd like to suggest today is that Tradition 12 is telling us we need to move away from that kind of thinking as quickly as humanly possible. And Jane's group needs to be the ACA group. John's meeting needs to be the Thursday night ACA meeting. Because when Jane and John leave or move on, we want to ensure that that group and that meeting are still there for the next adult child who needs them. We want anonymity to serve as our spiritual foundation. So now I'd like to very briefly consider, I'm keeping one eye on the clock. I'd like to very briefly consider Tradition 5, which deals with group purpose, and then wrap up with a look at Tradition 2, which is group conscience. So the first tradition told us what we are working toward here, which is unity. And Tradition 12 told us who is doing it, We all are in anonymity. Now, Tradition 5 answers the question, why are we doing this together? It tells us each group has but one primary purpose: to carry its message to the adult child who still suffers. Or, as I like to say, I'm here to help somebody if I can and ask for help if I need it. Put simply, the fifth tradition is 12-step work on the group level. We come together to do one thing: carry the message. We may have very dear friends in our group and we may feel very close to them, but we are not a social club. We may have very similar views on social issues, but we're not an activist group. We might feel very closely aligned spiritually, but we're not a church and we're not group therapy. We exist so that newcomers are able to find the recovery they're looking for in a safe, welcoming place, and returning members know that they will be able to hear and share the message of recovery without the interference of outside issues. When it comes to what constitutes an outside issue, you hear a wide variety of opinions. At one extreme, some people say there should be no talk about gambling problems, drugs, or sexual addiction, pornography, or personal struggles with alcohol. We should stick exclusively to the issue of growing up in an alcoholic or dysfunctional home. At the other extreme, some people think there should be no restriction at all on what is discussed in an ACA meeting as long as the speaker isn't making threats or behaving violently. Well, these are things for each group to decide. My own view, and it's only one opinion of one member of ACA, is that adult children in relapse, including myself, can turn to a lot of different addictive behaviors. And it's helpful to be able to admit to them in meetings. I believe that the subjects that are truly outside issues are religion and politics. As an ACA myself, whose childhood included serious spiritual and religious abuse, I am so grateful for ACA's inclusive attitude towards spiritual beliefs and practices, and I know others who feel the same. And I feel very protective of that. I should also add on a personal note that as a member of AA, I feel very defensive and protective of ACA as a separate and unique recovery program. I always try to be mindful of the fact that when I attend an ACA meeting, I'm in a room with people who have been abandoned by alcoholics and traumatized by their behavior. I don't hide the fact that I'm also in AA. And I do allow myself to discuss my history with alcohol, but I leave the AA program outside the door. With that said, here are a few checkup questions that I can ask myself to see how I'm doing with Tradition 5, which is carrying the message. Do I make sure that newcomers feel safe and welcome? Do I reach out to them and introduce myself? Do my shares include at least as much strength and hope as experience, and at least as much experience of growth as experience of pain? Do I share my own experience in the first person and avoid third person narrative? Do I listen to the shares of others with my full attention and an open heart? And do I truly carry the message? And then two important Tradition 5 questions for the group to ask itself. Do we make regular contributions to Intergroup and WSO? That too is carrying the message. And then when it comes decision-making time, does what we are about to do support the primary purpose of carrying the ACA message to another adult child needing help? And that question brings us straight to Tradition 2, which is about group conscience. And it states, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as expressed in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Right away, I'm hit with a question. Do I really believe that a loving God, or a loving power, if you prefer, expresses itself in our group conscience? Or am I secretly holding on to the old idea that I know what's best for the group and it's up to me to convince the others to do things my way? This is where the rubber meets the road for some of us who have been around for a while and maybe believe that our experience entitles us to make decisions on behalf of the group. And the same question may come up for those who started a new group and feel deeply invested in its success. In the beginning, they had to make all the decisions, and it can be hard to know when to let go and trust in group conscience. In some groups, a small number of people who hold service positions may be the only ones who attend business meetings, and they've simply become accustomed to making all the decisions and matters that affect the whole group. And then the opposite problem may come up for newcomers or those with less experience. They may be still afraid of people and authority figures, and not yet used to having their voices heard. And they may be completely uncertain how to express their opinions in a group without authority figures. Whatever the particular dynamic, it helps to remember that we are all adult children. We're all struggling to find our voices in healthy adult relationship. We all make mistakes, and that in our ACA group, we have a safe place to practice being a member of a healthy family and making decisions in the form of group conscience. If we put the common welfare first, place principles before personalities, and focus on the group's primary purpose, we're well on the way to trusting that a loving God or a loving power expresses itself in our group conscience. I'll just wrap up quickly here with the actual mechanics of taking group conscience vary somewhat from group to group and from decision to decision, and that's fine. The following has been our experience in ACA Tallahassee, based on the collective wisdom of other ACA groups and group conscience. One, in matters that affect the entire group, we should make every effort to hear every voice. If few people are attending the business meeting, we should hold a group conscience meeting during the regular meeting time, or call a special group conscience meeting. Hearing every voice means calling on those who do not raise their hands and assuring them that their opinion matters and is heard. And by the way, what is not tradition to work is when two or three people get together before the group conscience and decide the outcome of the vote ahead of time and strategize about how to convince everybody. That's not the voice of a loving God. That's the voice of the ego. It's called stacking the deck. Two, and we found this to be very important in Tallahassee, slow down. There is no emergency except in cases of group safety or the safety of individual members. There's time to hear from everyone, and the process is more important than reaching a quick decision. Three, in group conscience meetings of five or more members, a volunteer should chair the meeting who does not express any opinion or cast a vote. The role of the chairperson is to moderate the discussion, time the shares if needed, keep the group focused on the matter under discussion, and remind the group to place principles before personalities. Four, if a vote is taken, it should reflect the clear will of the group in the form of substantial unanimity. Substantial unanimity is more than a simple majority. It should be at least two-thirds of the vote. Five, if there are dissenting votes, the chairperson should solicit minority opinion. Actively solicit minority opinion. Minority opinion is very important to a successful group conscience. After all minority opinions have been expressed, another vote should be taken to determine whether we still have substantial unanimity or whether minority opinion has swayed the vote. And if there is still substantial unanimity, the minority should be asked whether they will accept the clear will of the group. And finally, if at all possible, all of this should be done with gentleness, humor, love, and respect. Thank you all so much for allowing me to share with you today. It's wonderful to be part of Atlantic Southeast Intergroup.